Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first three meals free.
Hey there, it's The Takeaway for Friday, September 9th, 2016.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. You know, you can't find a sign in a hotel in America that says whites only. It's actually illegal under the Civil Rights Act. You can observe considerable hate speech and angry racist rhetoric in the no-rules world of the internet these days. We've certainly seen plenty of that during this election campaign. So is it any surprise that behind the glitzy, friendly website of the popular online home-sharing service Airbnb, there may be people with an invisible whites-only message to African Americans trying to rent their homes? Rohan Jilks in Tampa, Florida, do you feel like you got the whites-only brush off when you tried to use Airbnb?
Absolutely. I was trying to head to Idaho, and on Airbnb, you sign up and you have a profile picture. And I went on trying to book a place, and I found a place that I really liked. And I looked at the availability on the calendar, and it was available. And I selected those dates and requested to book. And the host responded and said that they were actually going to be using the property that same time, and basically, good luck. So what I did was I had one of my white friends to request the same dates that I was told were unavailable, and they were approved right away.
There you go. So you're a citizen in Tampa, Florida, right?
Yes.
And what have you decided to do about all of this, which sort of gets you into the business of competing with Airbnb? What are you starting?
I'm starting a company called Inclusive.com. And it's very much like Airbnb in function, but we are looking to focus very, very heavily on solving some of these problems around discrimination and bias in short-term rentals.
Now, Rohan Jilks, have you filed a lawsuit against Airbnb?
I have not.
All right. But a number of users have filed complaints with the company, even class actions, saying that they had been mistreated or outright rejected out of rentals due to one of the above factors and circumstances that sound very much like Rohan's story. Hold on there for a minute, Rohan. After months of complaints, Airbnb acknowledged it has a problem with discrimination. It's now offered a commitment to fixing it. The company assembled a team of engineers and lawyers, including U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder, to address ways to root out potential avenues of discrimination. Yesterday, it released a 32-page non-discrimination policy, making several tweaks that they say will make the platform more equitable. Rohan, did you take a look at this 32-page document?
I did. I went through it thoroughly.
And yes. What did you think? What was your reaction?
My reaction was basically that they did not go far enough. Actually, I think that the real practical outcome of their proposals will have a tiny, if any, real impact on bias on the platform. Because the things that lead to bias are very, very simple, like the picture of the person and the name of the person. Like those two things were studied very, very well and shown to be the root of the bias. And showing the picture of the person and showing the name is just going to insert potential for bias in the decision-making for the host. And nothing that they have proposed actually changes showing the picture and showing the name. I think without that, we're going to end up in the same situation on Airbnb.
That's Rohan Jilks, founder of Inclusive, a competing website to Airbnb that he's put together in response to an offensive set of circumstances that he believes were discriminatory as he tries to use Airbnb, which has over 60 million users in over 34,000 cities, 191 countries. It's a platform that in its short existence since 2008 has attempted to redefine short-term housing rentals. Joining us now is Nancy Leong, an associate professor at the University of Denver School of Law, who studies discrimination in the sharing economy. Nancy, what do you think of Rohan's story, and how much of a legal gray area is there here?
Well, I think that this story is one that is all too common. It's a lot like other stories that I've heard from a lot of different people. And I, first of all, am in agreement that while, to give credit where due, I think that this new policy does take some steps that are really commendable. And to my knowledge, no other sharing economy business has done anything even approaching this to try to reduce race discrimination by its users. You know, having said that, I would echo what Rohan said about the problem with including profile pictures, which can trigger both explicit racism and also implicit bias. And so it's really not clear to me why they didn't just get rid of the profile pictures. And the same thing with asking people to use their real names. I mean, you know, the Harvard Business School study that came out earlier this year showed that it was something like 16% more difficult for people with black-sounding names to get rentals. So I'm not sure that this is going to be anything like a complete solution.
But if you showed up at a hotel, a Hilton or any kind of hotel, and had a bag over your head and gave them a false ID, and obviously false ID, you know, they wouldn't give you a room. They'd tell you to get lost.
So I think that the issue there is whether it's automated or not. And in the case of a lot of mainstream, you know, traditional hotel websites, it is automated, right? You know, there's no sort of pre-screening process. You just put in your credit card information and book a room. And, you know, this is one of the changes that Airbnb has said that it's trying to implement, is to make what it calls instant book, where you can book a room without any kind of pre-screening by the owner.
Now, Rohan, let's note that you're in potential competition with Airbnb, and so I can understand that you would be skeptical of their changes here. You know, if they were set up like a, you know, Orbitz or a you know, Hilton website, do you think the discriminatory practices that you experienced would go away?
I do believe so, and this is a piece that I have to give them credit for as well. So basically, instant booking, that is really what it looks like on Orbitz and Travelocity. As long as your credit card goes through, as long as your card is not declined, you have a place to stay.
Talking to Rohan Jilks, who had an experience online with the Airbnb that he found discriminatory. Nancy Leong, it's possible to view these this 32-page non-discrimination policy as a fix, but is it more a question of making them look good in a court case, or is it a specific fix that brings it in line with the Civil Rights Act itself?
So I think that it potentially is both. You know, it's something that is done with good intentions, but is also done with the intention to reduce legal liability. And I think it's worth pausing for a minute just to take a look at the history of the Civil Rights Act, which you've already mentioned. You know, in the 1960s, Congress passed these public accommodation laws to prohibit discrimination in places like hotels and restaurants because black people who were traveling previously had trouble finding a place to stay or a place to eat in a lot of parts of the country. Well, you know, fast forward to today, the argument is that Airbnb should also be subject to these laws, because even though it's not a traditional hotel, it's functioning the same way as a hotel. It's meeting the same needs. And so I think that while this has not been tested in the courts yet, there is certainly concern on the part of Airbnb and other businesses in the sharing economy that these old public accommodation statutes could be used to apply to these new businesses.
What about something that happens online that we can all well imagine? Say someone decides to start a business a little bit like Rohan here, but with a very different intention. My old Kentucky home, B&B, all right? And nothing said on there about discrimination, but there's a sort of a message that people know that if they put their houses up here, that the people who are going to be booking on this website are going to be of a particular demographic, and there's a business that's created out of sort of pre-screening. Is there a way that becomes immediately illegal, even if there's no explicit message of discrimination?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting problem. And one statute that I would be thinking about here is the Fair Housing Act, which requires racial neutrality in selling and renting and just generally transacting with real estate. And the interesting thing about that statute is that to win, a plaintiff doesn't need to show that a renter had bad intent, which I think gets around the problem that you're describing, that it's only implication, right? Like nothing's explicitly said. So the plaintiff doesn't need to show that a renter actually had bad intent, only that there was a racial disparity in the way that people are treated.
Rohan, can you imagine a business that would market itself without an explicit message, but that you would get the message that you're not welcome there?
Very often websites will show, like, you know, faces of people and people having fun and enjoying their products and services. And for many websites that you see, there's like 100% of the people that are being reflected in their branding and their marketing and their communication are not people of color. There's sometimes some subtle signs that people of color have learned to pick up on and use in their navigation of the world. So there's some even more subtle things that could happen beyond just something like a Confederate flag.
Rohan, we're very sorry for your experience and good luck on your new business called Inclusive, okay?
Thank you so much.
And Nancy Leong, any other things you would want to add here? This is a very, very interesting issue.
Well, just the one final thing I would say is that I think that this is an issue that is not going away anytime soon. You know, this question of how these civil rights laws that were passed in the 1960s applies to sharing economy businesses, not only Airbnb, but other businesses like Uber would be another example. You know, how these old laws apply to these new business models is one that I think courts and legislatures are going to be struggling with for quite a while to come.
Nancy Leong is Associate Professor at the University of Denver School of Law. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Arslan. I'm calling from Chicago, Illinois. I have had instances where I've gotten dirty looks because of my brown skin color, but I try to be nice, even after the things that people say to me. Usually it works out fine because I'm usually nice to them. You would be shocked how people can be biased and still be nice to you if you're nice to them, regardless of how they look at you and how they talk to you.
Hi, my name is Sarah Ismail, and I'm calling from Berkeley. When I was in Israel, I was wearing a headscarf, also called a hijab, since I'm a Muslim woman, and I was having trouble changing a bus ticket in person at the kiosk. So I noticed there was a phone number to call on the back of the ticket, and when I called with my American accent, I was able to change the ticket very easily.
So we're asking you, have you been discriminated against while booking a hotel, renting a car, utilizing some kind of service? A story like Rohan's that we heard just a few minutes ago. Rockland, Massachusetts, being gay actually helped in my favor because the concierge was gay and gave me a great rate and opened the pool late for me and my partner. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Comment at thetakeaway.org. Stories of discrimination on The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. Learn more at TIAA.org.
It's been 53 years since the Supreme Court ruled in Gideon v. Wainwright that everyone has a right to an attorney, even if they can't afford one. That decision created the need for public defenders trained in criminal defense to represent defendants and to ensure that they have a fair trial. But the growing prison population and lack of funding for public defenders has led to overworked attorneys with limited resources and no relief, hence unequal justice. The Marshall Project, in partnership with The Guardian, is in the middle of a three-part series examining the consequences local jurisdictions face as they struggle to uphold the Constitution and provide legal defense for defendants as required under the Gideon v. Wainwright Supreme Court decision. Eli Hager is staff writer at The Marshall Project. His research took him down to the rural parishes of Louisiana. Eli, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
And Rhonda Covington is down there in those parishes, district defender in parishes in East and West Feliciana in the state of Louisiana. Rhonda, welcome to the show.
Hi, John. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
How much of a struggle is it to defend and deal with the caseloads that you are getting, and what are the consequences for defendants?
Well, it's a tremendous struggle for me as an attorney and as the district defender, because I have to oversee all of the cases that come through. We have a growing caseload and not nearly enough resources in order to deal with the issues that we have. We need things like investigators, translators, attorneys, you know, just to name a few. And it has an impact on the people that we represent. I've got people who call me on a daily basis and want me to, why aren't you at the jail? Why aren't you meeting with me? Why aren't you helping me? And when, you know, I explain that I have got over 200 open felony cases, given the responsibilities that I have, I can't be there for all of them the way they want me to be.
Eli Hager, have you viewed that situation that Rhonda is describing broadly throughout the parishes you investigated?
I did see it broadly. Rhonda's situation is particularly extreme because she is the only full-time attorney there in her entire district, which handles over 900 cases. So she has a particularly extreme scenario. But in three or four of the other parishes I went to, and in all of the parishes in Louisiana, they're having to put defendants on wait lists for a lawyer because they just had so many cases and not enough lawyers. So it's very common.
How are public defenders funded in the state of Louisiana?
So one of the unique things about the state of Louisiana is that they're funded primarily by traffic tickets at the local level. So there's a fee attached to traffic tickets and other court fees that goes to the public defender's office, but it's very unstable. So if the police aren't writing as many tickets, or if there's a flood like there was recently and there aren't as many people in court and not as many tickets being written, their funding goes down the drain. They get a portion of their funding from the state, but that was also cut this year because of a huge budget crisis that Louisiana had. So it was kind of a 1-2 punch that public defenders around the state faced this year.
If they get the money from traffic tickets, is it the case that essentially the prosecutor's side of the equation controls the money for the public defenders on some level?
The district attorneys have the power to do a pretrial intervention. And they do that with the traffic tickets, which is our bread and butter. So what they'll do is to send a letter to the people with the tickets and say, hey, if you want this kept off your record, pay the fines and do this or do that. But you pay the fines directly to the district attorney's office, and they get 100% of those fees, and we get nothing. So basically, the DA's offices around the state are able to control how much money each district receives.
Rhonda Covington is something of a one-woman show in the 20th District, which covers two parishes in Louisiana. As Eli Hager said, over 900 cases. You have to do all the office work, the mail, everything. You're the sole attorney there, and you still do individual pleas. Eli, describe the mass pleas that you observed.
Right. So in the 16th district, which is a little ways away from where Rhonda works, I witnessed mass pleas. So this is a hearing in which 30 or even 50 people are kind of pleading to felony cases all together. So they're convicted and they're sentenced all at once in a hearing that lasts only a few hours. And
these are all different crimes.
These are all different crimes, and these are all serious crimes. So some people were being sent on the spot to prison for 10 or 15 years. And they're read their rights all together. So the judge will say, do you understand your right to a jury trial? And then the whole group of them will say, yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir. Do you understand your right to counsel? Yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir. So it's kind of this mass processing that happens. And it's partly because it's something that's happened in that district and some other districts for a long time, but it's been exacerbated by the overload that the public defenders are feeling and the fact that they can't give more individual attention to each of those cases.
Demographically, who are these defendants? What do they look like?
Almost entirely Black. They're all indigent because these are all cases that the public defender is handling. But they were mostly Black. So you see this eerie scene in the courtroom of defenders and prosecutors and the judge all being white, and they're kind of facing this panel of mostly Black defendants who are all in chains at the ankles, at the waist, and at the wrist. They have not been convicted yet, but they're all pleading together to crimes and will about to be sent to prison together.
Rhonda, where does the satisfaction come in your job? And tell me about a victory or two.
Well, the satisfaction comes from helping the people who need help, regardless of their situation, whether or not they're homeless or drug addicted. If we can get them into a program, that's a wonderful thing. And we've done that. I mean, I had a guy who was a Vietnam veteran who had gotten addicted to drugs while in Vietnam, and he was in his 60s and was caught with drugs for the very first time. And we got him into a rehab through the VA, and in which he stayed for over a year. And he came out of there a whole new man. And that was a wonderful victory there, just seeing the change in his life. There are a lot of people who are accused of crimes, and sometimes it's with little more than just a rumor. And I think that if the public really realized what was going on, that they would be afraid. They would be very afraid.
Rhonda Covington is district defender in parishes in East and West Feliciana in the state of Louisiana. Rhonda, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
And Eli Hager is a staff writer at the Marshall Project. His research took him to Louisiana as part of a three-part series that the Marshall Project is doing with The Guardian on the situation of public defenders in the United States. Eli, thanks to you.
Thanks for having me.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Is North Korea's fifth and apparently successful nuclear test some kind of familiar symbolic message to its neighbors or a viable device that would be used in a future offensive missile force targeted at South Korea, Japan, or even the U.S.? President Obama has condemned the test and said the U.S. will never accept North Korea as a nuclear state. But it's looking pretty nuclear right now. Joining me is Paul Bracken, professor of management and political science at Yale. Welcome to The Takeaway, Paul.
Good to be here.
I don't understand why the North Koreans need to continually demonstrate this. They aren't looking to develop an offensive weapon, are they? I mean, if they are, and that's the only possible use for this, I can't imagine what scenario they're imagining here.
Well, I think they are developing an offensive weapon with enough reliability so that it keeps the United States off their back. What that means is if they push the button, the missile will take off and it'll have a nuclear warhead on it. And all this warhead has to do is to reach Japan, South Korea, probably down the road. They want one that can hit targets in the United States. What are the scenarios where this could be, you know, used by the North Koreans? I think there's several. If the regime is collapsing and it looks like the United States and perhaps China are piling on to make it collapse faster, I actually think, and I think most experts who study North Korea, they would hit the button. They would destroy four or five Japanese cities and two or three South Korean cities. It's also a deterrent. You don't have to fire a nuclear weapon to use it.
But what is the deterrence? I mean, the North Koreans, I mean, if they're capable of putting together a nuclear weapon, someone in North Korea must understand that no one's going to nuke North Korea. So the deterrence is already working. What's the value of actually having the weapon unless it's to tell a story for domestic consumption? It's in a pretty expensive way to do it.
They're not trying to deter a U.S. nuclear attack only, but to deter something else. What is it? Basically, it's the U.S. pushing them around too much, such as putting an embargo quarantine around North Korean ports so that nothing could come in and out. Secondly, diplomatic activities in which we would confiscate their bank accounts in Hong Kong and in certain European capitals. Activities where we would demand that no one in the world would accept a North Korean passport. which would mean that they would not be able to travel to any country. So what they're trying to deter is a bunch of smaller activities, which, given the weakness of their economy, could push them over into an internal collapse.
I guess the irony, though, is the closer North Korea gets to an offensive nuclear weapon that they're capable of actually deploying and using, the more likely it is that a preemptive strike would try to take it out.
It's a delicate calculation in North Korea not to be too provocative. They want to make a warhead that shrinks and fits on the middle missiles that you could actually fire and have detonate, because they know that that capacity, when the United States looked at it, would make us really not press them too hard on the diplomatic economic warfare front. But I think they're making a rush to having a serious missile force that can hit just enough Japanese and Korean cities to make us stand back and not escalate the pressure.
We've been speaking with Paul Bracken, professor of management and political science at Yale. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Is Nigeria taking an economic plunge after being the third fastest growing economy in the world in 2015? Political stability in Nigeria has enabled the government of President Muhammadu Buhari to get international loans from the World Bank and others, but a failure to diversify away from dependence on falling and disruptible oil has caused a steep decline in the country's currency and dangerous inflation to accompany an already shrinking recession economy. Chris Stein is Nigeria correspondent for the VOA News, and he joins me now from the busy streets of Lagos. Chris, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thanks a lot.
First of all, what's going on in Nigeria economically?
This year, there's been two consecutive quarters of economic contraction. So what that means is that the country just entered a recession from the end of the second quarter. Those statistics were announced, I think, last week. So that means that we're expecting, overall, the economy is expected to shrink for the rest of the year by many estimates. And people are expecting growth to return perhaps early next year. But it's hard times in Nigeria right now.
Is it oil driven? There certainly is a beginning of a diversified economy in Nigeria. But again, the recession really sort of hurts all boats.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, there are other industries in Nigeria, and economists do debate how diversified the economy is. But oil is still perhaps the biggest industry in the country and its top export. One of the first things that happened was the global drop in oil price, which kind of started at the end of 2014, accelerated through 2015. And, you know, prices are still low this year. But that was a global thing. What was really unique to Nigeria was, first of all, the supply disruptions. And by that, that basically meant people blowing up pipelines, blowing up oil platforms or infrastructure platforms in the oil-producing Niger Delta region. That's something Nigeria has seen before. It ended in 2009 when the government started a program to pay off militants every month and also provide some with job training. And that kept the peace for a while. But for a variety of reasons, that's restarted starting from, I think, you know, January or February of this year. So not only is Nigeria's top export worth less on the global market, Nigeria is producing less of it. And that combined with what many economists say are some decisions made by the federal government have led to this recession.
A year and a half ago, the Nigerian government could really project to Africa and the world that it was stable and was moving forward. Is that less likely now with the two quarters of recession?
Well, you know, the government is indeed stable. I mean, they just last year had their first transfer of government from one party to the other, had an incumbent president step down. You know, they're proceeding now with state governorship elections. So there aren't major political risks going on right now. I mean, in all likelihood, President Muhammadu Buhari will, you know, finish out his first term and either stand for re-election unless he decides not to. So on the political sphere, things are fairly stable. The question right now is, what's going to happen to the economy? What's going to happen with the price of oil? Can Nigeria pacify its Delta region once again and allow the resumption of oil production so that the economy can get back to growing? And will the government's economic policies start paying off and help return the economy to growth? Many people, you know, economists I've spoke to do expect that growth will return in 2017. But, you know, it does remain to be seen and depends on how much borrowing Nigeria's government could do overseas, how effective that borrowing can be, if projects will actually be completed. Many people are advocating spending by the government to help kind of improve, to help pull it out of this recession. So we're going to see all this over the coming months.
Well, Chris Stein, Nigeria correspondent for VOA News, we can certainly hear the liveliness of Lagos and its street life right outside your window there. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Today, Junior!
60% of the time, it works every time.
That doesn't make sense.
Everyone in this room is now dumber for having listened to it.
I didn't get a harumph out of that guy.
Give the governor a harumph.
Harumph!
You get nothing! You lose! Good day, sir!
Post-Labor Day movies with Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Time to look at the post-summer blockbuster offerings. Welcome.
Thank you, John.
And the first movie is called Sully. And is this a solo character breakout movie for the character in Monsters, Inc.?
No, no, it's a good guess. No, it's Captain Chesley Sullenberger, the guy behind The Miracle on the Hudson. He's played by Tom Hanks with Clint Eastwood directing.
Mayday, mayday, mayday. This is Cactus 1549. Hit birds. We've lost thrust on both engines. We are turning back towards the LaGuardia.
Which engine did you lose?
Both engines.
Ignition?
Ignition.
Thrust levers. Confirm. Idle.
Idle.
Cactus 1549, if we can get it for you, do you want to try to land runway 13?
We are unable. We may end up in the Hudson.
So this is a 75-second movie?
No, it's about 2 hours. And that's Tom Hanks, of course, doing a great job as Sully. You know, you can hear that very calm moment. Both engines, very calmly stated. They're in midair with a completely lost thrust. The crash scene, or I should say the emergency landing scene, is very gripping. You know, that scene where everyone's standing outside on the wings of this plane in the middle of the river. They're all stunned to be alive. It's a very goose-pimply moment. I do think that Clint Eastwood makes a strange choice here by trying to show us Sullenberger as a kind of traumatized vet, you know, suffering from PTSD, which I'm sure was true. But he also casts the National Transportation Safety Board as the villain. They seem to want to hang Sully throughout this entire movie, which is not really how I remember it, and that's not really how it wound up happening. And I think my main problem here is that Eastwood wants to make Sully a kind of stand-in for all the vets that returned home and never got this sort of due that they were owed by the country from an ungrateful public or a knock-kneed Congress. And I don't really think that's what Sullenberger was. I just think he was a guy who did a great job and did the best he could. That's all he ever said he was. And he wanted to get out of the limelight and get home to his wife.
But it's an entertaining movie. You know, before I quote, Clint Eastwood saying, "Do you feel lucky, punk?"
Well, do you?
Yeah.
You know, there's something a little flat about the film also, because Sullenberger was never the most charismatic guy. He never claimed to be. And so you've got this kind of modest, retiring, private guy as the hero of your movie. I'm not sure that works that well.
Jerry Lewis back in the movies in Max Rose. Here's a little clip.
What is that?
Read it.
59. I thought you gave it to her. No? Well, maybe it's a family heirloom.
You could possibly recognize the telethoning voice of Jerry Lewis in there. What is this? What is this movie?
He is playing a failed jazz pianist who discovers that his late wife may have had an affair. He's talking there to his granddaughter, Carrie Bechet, about a compact that he's discovered that has an inscription that leads him to believe that she had a lover. And so much of the film is him trying to track down this mystery. I think the selling point here is this is the first time we've seen Jerry Lewis in a major role in about 20 years, and he's playing sad, which is not the kind of thing we usually associate with Lewis.
I remember him in King of Comedy. He was unbelievable.
Well, exactly. And he's great. So I think it feels to me as though the director kind of didn't realize that Jerry Lewis has already played a serious role. And so much of the film is just spent lingering on his face as if we're supposed to be totally fascinated that this famous clown of Hollywood can, in fact, play sad. Mm. But we kind of know that already, and the story doesn't really add up much, and it becomes a very dreary, very simplistic film. And it's kind of too bad because, you know, Jerry Lewis is 90, and he doesn't have many films left in him, and I would like them all to count if he's going to come back, you know?
2 seconds on The Wildlife, which was also released this weekend.
That's right. Animated film, kind of a take on the Robinson Crusoe story. Castaway lands on an island of talkative animals. Not good on pretty much every level. You know me in kids' films. I'm hard to please, but this one really does not clear the bar.
Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Thanks so much, Rafer, and have a great weekend.
Thanks, John. You too.
Do you feel lucky, punk?
Well, do you?
Someday, when I'm awfully low,
when the world is cold, I will feel a glow
just thinking of you and the way you look tonight.
Yeah, right. That's not Sinatra or Fred Astaire in a razor-sharp suit that I see when I look in the mirror. How do you get that hip menswear feel without channeling John Hamm in Mad Men?
And you know what happiness is? Happiness is freedom from fear.
During Fashion Week in New York this year, the range of options for men is a galaxy that spans the distance from Homer Simpson.
Marge, the boy was wearing a Hawaiian shirt.
To Mark Zuckerberg in his CEO hoodie, to Will Smith, or Empire's Lucius Lyon.
Lucius' look is inspired by Tony Montana, Berry Gordy, Clive Davis, Z, Russell Simmons, Puffy.
Well, I believe that Lucius feels that presentation is everything.
In menswear, the possibilities are endless these days, and anyone can play dress-up in Daddy's Closet. Patricia Mears is the deputy director of the museum at the Fashion Institute of Technology. Patricia, welcome back to The Takeaway, and thanks for being with us here during Fashion Week.
Thank you so much, John.
So let's talk a little bit about menswear. The fashion associated with men has changed a lot. And it's also the case that the clothes that men wear has changed a lot. And the places where you do this sort of – I mean, sneakers, for instance, are a gigantic apparel fashion element that never were before.
That's correct.
What can you say sort of overarchingly about the menswear industry right now?
Well, a lot has changed really starting in the late 1960s. The counterculture movement really opened up opportunities for men to wear a far wider range of clothes. And it also set the trend that we see now for people dressing much more casually. Men simply didn't go out onto the street until they had a suit, a tie, shirt, you know, really properly dressed, even if it was somewhat casual, tweed jacket and odd trousers. Today, a t-shirt, jeans, and sneakers really has become a work uniform, which is very unusual. But fashion in general has expanded, really exploded, if you will, over the past 10 years. The internet has certainly helped disseminate information. And it seems that every city in the world now has a fashion week. And not surprisingly, menswear, which is now considered men's fashion, has jumped on the bandwagon. And every conceivable type of garment is available, especially a lot of gender bending. You're going to see men wearing more feminine elements of clothing and women, of course, not surprisingly, adapting more menswear in their wardrobes too.
And jackets really cross over.
Absolutely.
So you can see t-shirts with jackets. You can see the classic, you know, GE CEO, wow, I'm radical, I don't wear a tie.
That's correct.
With a jacket.
Absolutely.
But you can also see a jacket with no shirt on at all.
That's right. And the whole concept of the jackets is such a modern garment. We were seeing it arise in the 17th century. And even in the 18th century, we saw women, Marie Antoinette, one example, wearing elements of menswear when she would go riding with her father-in-law, Louis XV. So this concept of borrowing and using the jacket as a staple of the wardrobe has always been around. But today, as you say, John, it's worn in so many variations. But the fact that it's constant is interesting.
Is it a cyclical thing? I mean, for instance, in the 20s, was that seen, you know, some kind of radical offshoot, or was that mainstream fashion to have women dressed in absolutely male fashion, three-piece suits?
It was cyclical. And remember, right after World War I, Europe was decimated. The male population dropped precipitously, and the role of women changed dramatically. The feminists really had a push forward. And we think of the flapper, but also so many women were wearing menswear ensembles. And by the 1930s, women really had the jacket, usually wearing a skirt during the day, but often trousers as well in other occasions, going to work that way. So this was not unusual. It was the post-war era era where we saw a strong return to femininity. Christian Dior was one of the big people to push that hyper-feminine look. But again, by the 1960s, all of that fell apart. And again, women in trousers, women in menswear suits became very, very constant. So cycle is important here, cultural cycle.
How about men? What is the reason for a man in 2016 to pay top dollar for a designer suit, or would they rather just get a hoodie like Zuckerberg?
It really depends on the person. While we've seen a lot of men become more casual and embrace many more elements in their wardrobe, there's a small but ardent group who still love traditional menswear. And so the role of the classic tailor has actually taken on new importance, and it's spread worldwide. Asia now is really one of the most important markets, not just for the consumer, but also for the designer and the people who are printing magazines. Some of the best menswear magazines are coming out of Asia.
And, you know, if we're going to use examples in the United States, Jon Stewart, for instance, it's sportswear.
Exactly.
That's Colbert right. is more of a suit guy.
That's right.
And Mo Rocca on CBS is like totally done up.
Yes, that's right. And again, remember that we're seeing, you were using the word gender bending. I do think elements such as the rise of gay culture has done a lot to give men tremendous freedom in what they wear. And there is also a sense of celebration in men's clothing. You're not looked down upon if you want to dress completely to the nines. And usually one figure will do both. It depends on what circumstance he's sitting in. And we'll see a lot of entertainers will wear a hoodie on one occasion but a full suit on another.
Yes, but does it play in Des Moines?
That's a very good question. Everything plays everywhere now. Again, access to the internet has helped. And remember that schools, which is where I am at FIT, we are not only national but international. So we get kids from all over the country, all over the world. But the reality is, if you look at mainstream America, most people are dressing down, dressing casually. The idea of going through the effort to buy a custom suit, let alone a regular suit, is just not going to be part of most people's choices.
What do students want to do to experiment if they express that feeling to be the next, you know, designer who's, you know, just absolutely wild and exciting?
I think a lot of it takes a certain amount of bravery and environment. One of the reasons why New York is nice is you have a lot more flexibility. If you do want to dress up or a little bit more outrageously, it's not going to cause quite the sensation as if you're going to walk down the street in Des Moines. So location helps a little bit. But I think, again, we're getting exposed to more and more things. The kids are much more open-minded. And if you ask a teenager or a 20-something, their concepts are going to be very different from a middle-aged American.
But we can safely say that the Lady Gaga wear a suit made out of meat is probably over.
I think so. Let's hope. I don't think it's a trend that most people want to embrace.
Patricia Mears, Deputy Director of the Museum at the Fashion Institute of Technology here in New York. Thanks so much, Patricia.
Thank you, John.
And here's a couple of things to take with you. First, my personal humiliation at how we've just ignored the Paralympics all this week, even though there have already been some notable wheelchair performances. And Dame Sarah Story won her 12th gold medal in Paralympic cycling in Rio. Listen.
She's not going to need very long at all. And this final is over already. More glory for Sarah Story in Rio, a piece of British sporting history.
More Paralympics coverage next week. I'll be gone, but Todd Zwillick will be here, and he's on the hook. And finally, an asteroid orbiting between Mars and Jupiter has been named for the lead singer of Queen, the late Freddie Mercury. The asteroid was discovered the same year Freddie Mercury died of AIDS. Brian May, guitarist for Queen, became an astrophysicist and has been leading this effort. Just remember, this asteroid, Freddie Mercury, is not to be confused with the planet Mercury. A reminder, you can take us with you this weekend. Subscribe to the Takeaway podcast on iTunes, a great way to stay up on the day's news. Again, you can find us on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.